everyone. I'm here with Joseph Turgeon, who is a Hoover Research Fellow from American University. He's very knowledgeable about China, Russia, geopolitical politics, a lot of things. He's also written a great book, which is launching in June. It is all about the Communist Party and how awful it is and deaths. It's a good read. It's very graphic. So welcome to my show, Joseph.
Thank you so much for having me.
First things first, do you think that I'm going to have to learn Chinese?
I don't think that you'll have to learn Chinese. You may like to learn Chinese, but I will recommend that if you do learn Chinese, that you get a really good teacher, because the problem with the Chinese language is that if you try to learn it on your own, it's really easy to get bad habits because it's a tonal language. And if you don't have a teacher that yells at you every time you get one of the tones wrong, then it can be a problem.
Why would it be a problem if you cannot pronounce things correctly? I do that all the time in English, and I'm totally fine.
So in the Chinese language, the tone is what makes the word have meaning. So I think if you can speak the language correctly as a foreigner, it's a way of winning people over and showing that you respect them and that you've put the time into learning the language correctly. And listening to someone who doesn't have their tones right in Chinese can sometimes be like listening to someone play the violin who's not very good at it.
Okay, so what you're saying is when China takes over, I'm going to be like Emperor Nero. I'm just going to be playing a violin really poorly. Before we begin, let's cover some basics. Joseph, what is a culture war? What starts it and what are the main factors that lead up to it?
There's a couple things that I could say about that. One is that Xi Jinping believes that after the century of humiliation, it was the Chinese Communist Party that proved to be the only way of organizing society in a way that would lead China back to its lost greatness. And so he believes that the Chinese Communist Party can break the cycle of dynasties that had marked Chinese history from the very beginning through this process of self-revolution. So essentially what he's saying is you can take Chinese history, which hasn't been broken for 5,000 years in his mind, and you can baptize it continuously in the revolutionary legacy that marked the Chinese Communist Party's rise to power. So what that means is Xi Jinping is someone who is deeply proud of China as a civilization. What he wants the world to believe is that there was a period where the West was turning every country into a version of the West, and that China has achieved its own mode of modernization, what he calls socialist modernization, which in his mind is a way of preserving China's distinct characteristics without being an appendage of what the West and liberal values.
Well, I mean, he's not wrong. McDonald's was in the Louvre. American culture has infiltrated every single country. I feel like everybody loves American things, even if they don't love America. Remember when I was 14, watched a documentary about North Korea, and all of these children were saying how much they hated America while wearing Disney shirts.
So Xi Jinping is someone who really cares about figuring out a way for the Chinese Communist Party to rule over the long term. And he believes that for that to be possible, you need to win over the younger generation into a spirit of idealism, motivation, sacrifice. And a challenge to that agenda is materialism and consumerism, Western values. And he thinks that if the United States wants to destroy China, one of the ways it can achieve that is by having the younger generation become essentially more interested in their daily lives and what they eat and what they dress than the national mission. And the other problem is that these materialist values can become a vector of corruption. And he knows what a big problem corruption is for the survivability of the regime. And he also seems to think that corruption makes them vulnerable to American espionage, to winning over people within the regime, to Washington's agenda.
You say his overall mission. What is that? Like, what is his ultimate goal here?
I think that he is a nationalist. He is someone who believes that China deserves to be on the leading stage. He's someone who doesn't want China to continue to go through these dynastic cycles. In fact, in one speech, he gave a scorecard for how many years the various previous dynasties had existed. And I think that he is worried that for revolutionary societies, there is a habit that after several generations, that people lose interest and they don't want to serve it anymore. So Xi Jinping has said that the first generation, they fought the revolution. You don't need to worry about them. the second generation, they witnessed the revolution, they saw their parents and were inspired by them, they're not a big worry. It's the third generation, the young people who are in China right now, that Xi Jinping believes are the target of what he calls a war without gunpowder. And that's a curious phrase, but essentially what he is saying is that because the United States won't fight a war to destroy communism, their biggest hope is that these young Chinese people will not want to continue lives of sacrificing for a national mission, which is something that Xi Jinping thinks is what they should do. He sees the life's meaning in this national project.
Right. So when I think about a war without gunpowder, that's what I think of as a cultural war, where you are still trying to accomplish some kind of mission that is not as effective if you allow people in it to die like you would in a normal war. But that's just my understanding of it. What separates culture wars from ordinary military conflict and regular war? What makes them different?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So when the early communists were thinking about the trajectory of world history, they believed that class struggle, that the working class could only emerge victorious through violence. They thought that violence was essentially the midwife to history. And in the 1950s, something changed. In the 1950s, nuclear weapons became tools of warcraft. And so the communist leaders in Moscow decided that it was no longer going to be a competition that was primarily violent, but one that was economic. And the Soviet leadership decided that they needed to figure out a way of showing that communism was superior to capitalism for providing people with a happy materialistic life. And so once that happened, the Soviet leadership decided that détente was the correct policy to pursue. So what is détente? Détente means that you have a relationship with the West that has cooperative elements. Now, certainly there's going to be competition. Certainly the relationship isn't always going to be smooth, but that because each side understands that the other isn't going to fight a war for ideological purposes to destroy the other nation, then the competition shifts into something else. So the Soviets, they believed that what the United States was trying to do, essentially, was to use Voice of America, to use jazz, interestingly enough, to use Coca-Cola to persuade Soviet citizens to act in a way that was not technically illegal, but was ideologically suspect. And so how you fight a war like that is really complicated, right? Because if people are doing things that you don't want them to do, but it's not illegal, then how you police them and how you control them suddenly becomes a very fraught question, because you want to struggle and you want to win the struggle, but you also don't want to turn everyday contradictions and young people acting like young people into this friend-enemy type contest, because then you're going back to the Stalin era, which is something that nobody wanted to go to because everybody had seen how disastrous that was. So it's a situation where you're trying to figure out how to be vigilant and how to protect your society from Western values, but also not completely shut yourself off and be able to benefit from trade and investment and technology. And that's a really tough balance to get right.
Very interesting. A lot of things I have questions on. I think it would make the most sense to my listeners and my audience if we were to first talk about the Russia versus US conflict and then the China versus US conflict. So it's really difficult to do this, but do you think you can summarize the Cold War in under 5 minutes? Do you think you can do that? Is that hard?
So you're asking about the Cold War, which for people in academia and in Washington, D.C., whether we are in a new Cold War or not, is one of the hottest topics of debate. The problem is to say whether or not we're in a Cold War now requires us to say clearly what the Cold War was. And of course, that's very challenging. And the reason it's challenging is that the Cold War was very different at different times. So there were moments during which the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union was very fraught, where we were nearly fighting a nuclear war, such as during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But then in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the Soviets and the Americans were working closely with one another to stop proliferation of nuclear weapons into other countries. So there were moments of cooperation, there were moments of competition. Also, I think the role of ideology played different roles at different times, right? So for example, in the People's Republic of China, they believed that the Soviet pursuit of détente was a huge problem. And they thought that the reason the Soviets weren't ambitious enough in their struggle against the West was because something had gone deeply wrong with the revolutionary project. Communists in Moscow weren't really communists anymore. So they used this word revisionism to describe them. And so when you are a communist and you accuse someone of heresy, that is a very, very dangerous charge. And that's one of the reasons that the relationship between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China collapsed. So that's also interesting to think about, right? Because the strategic triangle at the beginning of the Cold War, when China and the Soviet Union were allied, as opposed to the 1980s, when China was telling the United States that they were not aggressive enough in combating Soviet expansion, you know, whether or not the Cold War is a useful analogy or not, it comes down to whether or not it's useful for American policy today. So then the issue then is whether or not the basic contour of the Cold War, right, which is how you compete and cooperate at the same time without the competition making the cooperation impossible and the cooperation not giving a chance for the other side to just take advantage of you. Those central questions are maybe ones that are useful for understanding the relationship between China and the U.S. today. I think that there is one big similarity that's crucial, right, which is that if you look at the language that the Soviet leaders used to describe the nature of the American threat, it was that the Americans were pursuing peaceful evolution, that essentially what they were doing is trying to not destroy the Soviet Union with violence, but by winning over the newer generations of Soviet citizens, and that they talked about it as a virus. They talked about it as a cultural threat, really. I think that is a good way of thinking about it. And the Chinese talk about it in a very similar way, right? So the Chinese also have this preoccupation with peaceful evolution and these attempts by the United States to infiltrate their country with Western values. But there is one, I think, significant difference, right? Which is that, at least officially, the Soviet Union had a mission of exporting revolution. So the Soviets thought that as a great power, they had the right to support communist, leftist, and revolutionary organizations all over the world. And the United States said, well, if you're in favor of détente, then how can you be doing this at the same time? So that was a central dilemma. But the Chinese now are not really exporting a single orthodox version of communism. And Xi Jinping, I think, is someone who has very strong self-control. And one of the very few times we've seen him act uncharacteristically was on a trip to Mexico. He said that the Westerners have a habit, after eating their full, of sticking their fingers and criticizing Chinese human rights, but that it's strange for them to do that given the fact that China no longer exports revolution. Now, having said that, the Chinese, they like to talk about their system as being proof that a non-Western mode of modernization is possible, and they take a lot of pride when they teach about their achievements to other countries and when other countries study them. I think they would like the world to be safe for authoritarianism, and they've exported certain technologies and techniques to other countries, but they try to be a little bit careful about the ideological element of the contest with the United States, and they always criticize Washington when they say that it's a contest between democracies and authoritarians, and they say that that's Cold War era zero-sum thinking. They don't like the contours of the international community to divide in those particular ways, because they think that it makes them look bad. It associates them with regimes that are not savory, and that's been a problem with them as Russia conducts its war against Ukraine. But they're not bankrolling or training revolutionaries like China and the Soviet Union did for a lot of the Cold War.
So effectively, they're just hoping they'll win?
I think that the Chinese believe that the United States will act more and more brazenly as China becomes more powerful, because they think the United States will never accept a communist superpower. And so the Chinese see a rough road ahead. They don't want to fight a war, but I think what they're hoping for is that their growth will continue, whether it's faster or slower, but at the very least will continue to a point where the United States recognizes that opposing China simply won't work, and that China will be able to resume what Xi Jinping sees as its rightful place in their international order, and America will just have to come to terms with it. I think that's probably their biggest hope. And I think that when they think about the contest, they see their system as superior. because they see the West as a place where capital is dominant. This is the kind of language they use. Well, what does that mean? Materially wealthy, but spiritually poor. And so it's kind of an interesting to think about communists as being the ones who think that they have the superior spiritual gunpowder when they're supposed to be materialists. But they think that communism is something that is worth believing in, that the pride that they take in the revolutionary generation and what they achieved is something that is inspirational. They also think that the party is a way of organizing society beyond any single interest group. It's that the party doesn't have interests beyond the interests of the nation, which they say is different from the United States, where capital is dominant. And that because capital can't be controlled by the government, the United States over the long term will not be able to handle contradictions within society or be able to execute a functional foreign policy that's not based, in their view, on gambling and recklessness. That's how they see the world.
Sad I can't talk to you for 6 hours. So many things I want to know. Okay, I'll just start with, do you think China wants every single country to be communist?
So on the question of whether China wants every country to be socialist, I think there's a difference between what leaders might think about in their wildest dreams and what their practical policy goals are. So certainly it's the case that it's useful for the Chinese regime to see the world as a place that's safe for socialist nations, that they hope for a world in which what they see as leftist socialist values are triumphant. But they're also careful to say that every country needs to pursue its own national trajectory. So what does that mean exactly? Well, when the Chinese talk about ideology, they talk about it in a very interesting way. They say that the reason China stayed communist when other countries did not, because they indigenized Marxism, which is another way of saying that they can make Marxism be whatever they want it to be. Now, I'm not saying that Marxism as a set of ideas doesn't affect their calculus in any way, but it does seem that Marxism for them is more meaningful as a source of idealism and motivation than it is as a cookbook that tells them exactly what they need to do. And in fact, they say that the reason other countries were no longer communist is that the dogma ossified, as opposed to China, where it's a living thing and they're able to use it in more effective ways. So if that's how you think about Marxism and socialism, then it becomes this kind of double game where on the one hand, I believe that socialism is a superior way of organizing society, but you also don't say that every single country in the world needs to do things exactly the same as you. So sometimes they talk more about the universality of their model. Sometimes they talk more about the unique characteristics of their model. And sometimes it depends a little bit on the audience. But again, China doesn't want to be seen as exporting revolution. That's not useful to them because they don't want the world to see China as fighting a war for sort of the global socialist movement.
Something I think is very interesting about China, obviously, I am not as knowledgeable about the subject as you, but something I think is very interesting is that they have very effectively, I feel like, infiltrated American youth in a way Russia was not able to during the Cold War. I have actually had several conversations now with people my age or younger who talk about how great China is and how much better it is than America. Don't know how I feel about it. One of my friends went to China and she was talking about how great it was and how pathetic it is that America can't build a city, techno city like China has. Why do you think American teenagers and young adults are responding so positively to China, which is a country that hates American individualism and wants to see it destroyed? Versus like when you look at, I wasn't alive then, but I feel like youth during the Cold War were not pro-Russia. I don't think that was a popular thing to say that you loved Russia and you thought they were so much better than America.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So after COVID, I think that China's reputation on a global basis really took a hit, a really profound hit, and that the Chinese are only slowly figuring out how to change that. And it's been pretty hard for them. There is a subset of influencers online that I have noticed. China does really care about its reputation. And one of the things that they do is they try to find people who aren't Chinese to use social media to go online and point to, as you described, these new trains and skyscrapers and that kind of thing. But You know, how effective they are is a really interesting question, right? So, you know, how you are a good propagandist without looking like you're doing propaganda has never been an easy thing for communist societies to manage.
I'm totally going to ask my friend now if the Chinese government is paying her. I don't think they are, but, you know, you never know. What do you think about Trump's tariff plan? Like, just describe it. Do you think any part of it is good? Do you think it is just wholly a disaster? Just tell me.
I think people on the outside have struggled to understand whether or not tariffs are considered by the administration as something necessary for national security and for American manufacturing, or whether the tariffs are a tool of negotiation. But that, of course, bumps up against other things that the administration likes, such as a growing stock market, avoiding the inability for people to even buy things because they're not even on the shelves. And it looks like if the tariff war had lasted much longer, that's exactly what would have happened. And so we saw Donald Trump talking a little bit about this mission of national sacrifice and people buying fewer dolls and fewer pencils. And it looks like the American economy proved to be more vulnerable in the shorter term in ways that I think the Chinese, according to their way of thinking about America, would not be surprised by, which is that they do think that in the United States, because capital is dominant, that the administration will make decisions based on that, as opposed to China, where they say the regime is capable of imposing sacrifices that are good for what they see as a national mission.
Very interesting. Broadly speaking, who do you think currently has more global power? Soft power, hard power, so many different terms for power, the US or China? And you don't have to have any research to back this up. I'm just asking for what your gut says.
Well, there is research that we could look at that polls people throughout the world to see, you know, what they think of the United States and what they think of China. And those polls are susceptible to what happens in the news, right? So after COVID, of course, China's reputation over the world plummeted. And since the election of Donald Trump, America's reputation has fared poorly. With regards to Beijing, they're at an interesting moment where steps by the U.S. administration, in theory, could create openings for them to increase their popularity. But it's not easy for them either, right? And the reason it's not easy is because the nature of their system hasn't changed. And there are people in Europe, which is one of China's most important partners, that continue to be very worried about human rights violations. But the way that the Chinese economy is structured also makes it hard for them to win people over. And the reason for that is Xi Jinping has decided that for China to survive, it needs independent innovation, control over technologies, big industrial economy. And what that means is they don't consume a lot, but they export a lot. So for Europe and the developing world, that's a big problem, right? Because it means that it's harder for you to sell things that make your economy work. So how that's going to play out is something that we're watching right now.
Well, what does your instinct say? How do you think it's going to pan out?
I think at heart, really, the Chinese system has less to win people over than the United States, even though the United States has really not been doing a good job marketing itself recently.
I would agree with that. As a left-leaning person, I definitely agree with that. What are some examples of espionage, propaganda, and other forms of non-military conflict that are happening in this specific war? You can say TikTok. I know you said you didn't want to talk about it, but TikTok feels like a big one.
Espionage is clearly an important element of the U.S.-China competition. And what's we've seen in China, too, is that there has been a popularization of the search for American agents in China. So there were like commercials or ads or programs and all this kind of thing to heighten the average regular Chinese person to the possibility of the United States trying to use them in the global espionage war. What's interesting is, you know, this gets into a lot of the themes we were talking about earlier, one of which is when Xi Jinping first came to power, one of the first things he learned was how deeply the United States intelligence services had penetrated his regime. And they found them, they rounded them up, they killed them. But for you to come to power and to learn that, it's probably a moment that really concentrates the mind. And he's someone who sees a lot of threats as interlinked in kind of complicated ways, but he does seem to believe that corruption, lack of revolutionary elan, is a vector not only for U.S. influence, but also for American intelligence. And the Chinese attempts to access U.S. infrastructure on various classified American databases. It's been interesting to figure out like what is considered a par for the course and what is considered a major dangerous escalation that requires a very strong American response. It does also raise interesting and difficult questions for American society, right? Which is how we treat immigrants from China, how we treat people, you know, Chinese American background. And so there was this FBI program to look for alleged spies, and it didn't do very well, and it seems to have targeted innocent people. So you know, how you balance the needs of an open society with this competition with China is something that we're figuring out and sometimes struggling to figure out.
If America is so concerned about Chinese infiltration, propaganda, and espionage, why don't they just ban TikTok? Why? It's on almost every American's phone. I've downloaded it on my phone a few times, I have to be honest. But remember the first time I downloaded it, my newsfeed was all pro-China videos. It was like, yeah, it was like China fashion, amazing. China has the best food. I wish I had taken a video of it. Like I'd gotten my friend's phone and taken a video because it was just so heavy-handed, just like slapping me in the face with how great China was. Why hasn't America just banned it? It's like actually crazy to me that we have a Chinese spyware app just available for download.
Yeah, I also feel the pressure of downloading TikTok. As for why TikTok hasn't been banned, the recent news suggests that the Trump administration may see what happens to TikTok as part of a deal with China. And especially as we have the ceasefire in the tariff war, it's possible the future of TikTok might be part of that, but we will have to see. But it certainly is striking that there was a legal decision about TikTok and Trump administration has decided not to enforce it for what are political reasons that raise interesting rule of law questions. We'll have to see what happens.
Normally, I don't share my opinions on this podcast, but I will say the way American children use TikTok is very reminiscent of how Chinese youth used opium. It's really bad. It's destroying your brain, and yet you are addicted and you cannot stop. Just download Instagram and stare at the little tiny reels if it's so important to you to watch 15-second videos. Delete it right now. Oh my God. Okay, how do the U.S. and China interact economically?
Well, I'll have to see what day of the week it is because of what the future of the U.S.-China economic relationship is like and what it will be in the future has certainly been very hard for people to predict. There was no one I knew who predicted that tariffs would go that high, and there was nobody I knew that predicted that there would be a ceasefire as dramatic and as sudden as there was. So at heart, the nature of the U.S.-China relationship, economically speaking, is that the Chinese export a lot of goods to the United States and that there is this trade deficit. And that's something that has really gotten the attention of the Trump administration. And there are elements of the economic relationship that under the first Trump administration and during the Biden administration that were identified as creating national security vulnerabilities. And so the United States started to introduce what's called industrial policy to figure out ways of, for example, bringing semiconductor production back to the United States. But in China, the latest numbers I saw were that 16 million people were directly involved in producing goods to sell to the United States, and some 160 or 180 million people in China were employed in jobs that in some way were related to the export economy. And so once they make this money, a lot of the money that goes into the U.S. Treasury, right? But one of the core problems is that the Chinese government decided that to pursue growth, they weren't going to move to a consumption-oriented model, that they weren't going to work on a stronger social safety net, that they weren't going to put money into the pockets of regular people, that instead they were going to double down on technology and manufacturing. And so what that has meant is a lot of imbalances in the world economy. And it's one of the reasons why China's relationship with so many countries has deteriorated. And why China made that decision? Lots of interesting questions about that. One is, I think that it has a lot of positive benefits for a potential military conflict, right? If you control a lot of the technology, if you're jumping up the technological chain, that's useful. Also, not having certain parts of your industrial chain dependent on other countries, that's also kind of dangerous. But also just the ability to direct capital and decide where capital goes is something that authoritarian regimes like to do.
The way Trump talks about China, it's always been so interesting to me because I feel like you can say as a president, he flip-flops on many issues based on what is in vogue with his party at the time, especially with COVID, you know, the vaccine that was developed under his administration. He was the one that appointed Fauci. Okay, so you see all of this, his flip-flopping. He's been pretty, I would say, firm on his belief on China. There are all these interviews with him back in the 90s where he talks about how we're getting a raw deal, how the way China treats us is embarrassing, how it's humiliating. Do you think China is humiliating us? Do you think he's right?
If you look at China policy across the first Trump administration and the Biden administration, a lot of the steps that President Biden took to compete with People's Republic of China had built on what the first Trump administration did. And it was rooted in this idea that the United States had facilitated China's rise in the hope that China would change as it rose, that by integrating China into the world economy, it would become a responsible stakeholder, and that forces in society that wanted reforms to continue in a more positive direction, hopefully including political, that that would happen. And then during the 2010s, the consensus view in Washington emerged that that was a wrong bet, and that in fact the United States needed to recalibrate and make competition a much bigger part of the relationship with China. Now, that has proven to be challenging for Washington to figure out how to both cooperate and compete at the same time, because there was also a fear that if the competitive element got too pronounced, that would be dangerous, right? So there was all this talk of guardrails, and you know, how you have guardrails but also compete at the same time is kind of a hard thing to figure out and how to think about. But I think that this idea that China is a problem and that the United States needs to compete better is kind of a very popular one in D.C.
Didn't ask what was popular in D.C. I'm asking what you think.
So I think of myself as a scholar who is public-minded, but isn't someone who is within a policy decision-making cycle. I think that there are other people who are more equipped and spend more time thinking on what the implications are for how I understand China, which is my real area of expertise, for what the United States should or shouldn't do.
That is a very academic answer. So speaking of China's influence in the U.S., China and Japan have both financed more U.S. debt than any other country. Japan has edged out China. You can like Google it and AI will tell you China is number one, but that's not true. Japan is. Can you explain what that means to my listeners? And can you imagine any situation where that might pose a problem for America?
So China's export model means that they make a lot of money and they need to put the money somewhere. So a lot of it goes back into the United States. And by giving that money to the United States through buying these treasury bills means that interest rates are lower, as opposed to them not doing that. And it facilitates, again, the American ability to consume, which means buying more from China. I think that there was a brief moment a few weeks ago after the tariffs were introduced where it wasn't quite clear whether or not America was a good place to park your money like it had been in the past. And if that had been the outcome, it would have been really interesting to see what that would have meant for American power and the role of the dollar.
So essentially, it's just because the U.S. is a good place to store your money. Okay, that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. So do you feel like we're in a period of increasing tension between the United States and China?
I think that the relationship between the U.S. and China is one where it's going to be a little bit more tense sometimes, a little bit more calm other times. Just a few days ago, it was a moment of real intensity, right? Because the tariffs had skyrocketed, the Chinese were drawing upon all of this Maoist and Cold War imagery to justify their resistance to American tariffs and to inspire people to sacrifice to win this tariff war. Now Donald Trump is coming out and saying that the United States only wants to help China, that it doesn't want to hurt China, that there will be a big, beautiful deal. And, you know, I don't know what that's going to look like or not, but there will be some interesting fluctuations sort of within that set parameter of one that has both competitive and cooperative elements. And the challenge for American and Chinese policymakers will be how to balance that in a way that doesn't lead to a unnecessarily conflictual relationship that hurts everyone, but that also the United States identifies things that China does that don't serve America's interests and does something about it.
Okay, very interesting. Why do concepts of humiliation and retaliation seem to be such huge parts of Chinese culture? Even if the tariff war resolves itself, I have a feeling China is just not gonna easily let go of what was just done to them by the US. That's just a feeling.
Yeah, I don't want to say that Chinese culture is inherently about those things, but we can say that historical memory about humiliation by Western powers is a very powerful political idea in Chinese politics. And that emerges, of course, from the Opium Wars, the century of humiliation, this idea that China deserves to be a great power and that there was this interim that this didn't happen and China can never allow that to happen again. And at the same time, of course, there is that emotional resonance there. But at the same time, I think that they understand that certain kinds of conflict with the West are also not useful, and that what they want to do is still benefit from trade and technology and investment and that kind of thing, because we know that Xi Jinping is someone who wants the regime to be secure, long-lasting, resilient, and part of that agenda needs economic growth. And so you can ask people to sacrifice, but if you don't need to, that's also a good thing. And it looked like if the tariff war was going to continue, it would have meant some pretty severe economic dislocations in China. The one thing about the Chinese system we should remember too is they use nationalism to buttress their legitimacy, but it's also such a leader-friendly system, right? So what that means is the leaders are so powerful that if they want to change their mind suddenly, they usually get away with it pretty easily, right? So for example, after decades of anti-American messaging, when Mao decided that they were going to open a relationship with the United States and Nixon visited China, it was just as easy as that. Or when Xi Jinping reversed zero COVID, he just did it. You know, there are these perennial fixations, preoccupations about humiliation that Chinese leaders always care a lot about. But there are other things that are going through their minds too.
Right. I was just curious because I did read your book. It is embarrassing. I read your whole book on the plane and also in an evening here, which is really great. I just forgot the title of it. It's right in front of me. Yes, the party's interests come first. Something that struck me was humiliation really seems like a big preoccupation for Chinese leaders. You say there are other things on their mind, but I mean, it really seems like they care a lot about not being humiliated, that they really want to save face.
Well, actually, I think my book might illustrate this idea in a way that is intuitive. So imagine that you're part of an organization that for you is the entire source of meaning within your life. And what that means is when the organization tells you to do something that you don't want to do or makes a decision that you think is deeply wrong, you still put that organization's interests first. And this is an organization that is exciting to be a member of. It's an organization that's seen as a manifestation of a world historical force, that it's an organization in which people die for, an organization that people kill for, an organization that was able to take over the country even though it had been nearly destroyed on several occasions. And suddenly you're a leader in this kind of organization and you're one of the most powerful figures in the country. And the way for that organization to emerge victorious was precisely because it could put demands on people to put the organization's interests above their own. That you found meaning in essentially becoming a cog in a machine. That by destroying your own selfishness or individualism, which is the kind of words that they use, you were becoming something bigger than yourself. So you can see how that organization officially characterizes your contribution would really mean a lot. But you can also see how when that organization betrayed you, you would remain loyal to it. And so there's this interesting element of, you know, Bolshevik communist political culture that sees suffering as something noble, something meaningful, and that when you are put through horrific circumstances, even by your own party, that in a way it's something you take pride in because it does two things. One is it rededicates you to the cause, but it also reveals how much you believe in it, that even after you went through those experiences and you're still loyal, it's something that you take a lot of pride in. And so what's interesting is Xi Jinping's father, he was betrayed by his own party 5 times. But he never lost faith in the party. And in fact, sometimes he would brag to people about how much he had suffered when other people were complaining about the party and saying, yeah, you suffered, but look how much I suffered and I got over it, right? So here it's like this idea of the party is something that deserves your faith and dedication, even when it humiliates you. It's an interesting tension there.
I've heard in China, you can go to jail for owning a copy of the Bible. I wonder if they would send me to jail for liking Ayn Rand. Probably. They'd see my copy of The Fountainhead with all of the highlights and be like, we're going to put this girl away for a long time. So on that note, if communism is so great, socialism is so great, these systems are so great, why do they have to force so many people into them? One thing I can say about American individualism and our capitalistic system is that most people really like it. You have to put a gun up to someone's head to get them to shop or to own things or to start their own business. But you do if you want them to give it to you. So just tell me, what do you think about that?
I think we're getting into questions of the meaning of life, which are not easy to talk about. And you've described a life of consumer well-being, buying things, hanging out with your friends, spending time with your family. But that's not the only way that people have found meaning historically. And if we look at China, especially during the 1950s and 1960s, it was electric. The atmosphere was charged. It was like there was an electricity in the air. And so imagine that you see yourself as someone in a country that had been humiliated for decades, was emerging from war, and there was this revolutionary party that had won these incredible triumphs, and you were the next generation. You were going to inherit the baton. You were the successor to the revolution. You were going to put the nation first, the organization first. You were going to sacrifice. You were going to struggle. You were going to fight. You were loyal to Mao. So there was this pressure for people to be redder than red, to show that they were more loyal, they were more dedicated than anyone else. And part of that was the patriotic education. Part of it was what they were taught in the schools. And part of it was the nature of the political system where you were expected to be, you know, totally loyal to the top leader. And so what's interesting is a lot of people, they looked fondly upon those years when they were young, where everything was clear and everything was exciting. And when the Cultural Revolution happened, it took those feelings and facilitated a huge disaster. And so a lot of people felt very disillusioned, and they thought that they had been tricked, and they wanted to make up for lost time doing the kinds of things that you think are fun, like traveling and maybe studying overseas or making a lot of money and that kind of thing. And so it was a reaction to the failure of this exciting revolutionary project. And I think what Xi Jinping is trying to do is rekindle that excitement and get people worked up again about this idea of a national mission and struggle and vigilance and eating bitterness and putting national rejuvenation ahead of their own sort of private interests. And whether that's inspiring to people or not, we'll find out, right? I mean, this is a society that just went through COVID. It's a society where the economy is slowing down. So I think Xi Jinping wants people to be susceptible to that message, but whether they want to go on the merry-go-round or not is something that we'll find out. But for Xi Jinping, it's something that's existential.
Something I find really interesting about The Great Leap Forward, and also something I found super interesting in your book, it just seems like there's a lot of purging of people in China. I mean, Great Leap Forward, I probably do not have to cover who Mao decided would lose their livelihoods and lives. Why is purging such a big part of Chinese strategy when it comes to getting their ideology across? I mean, literally just kill a bunch of people indiscriminately whenever they find that a group of people does not represent their interests. That is beyond an oversimplification, but I feel like just it is what it is.
So it's certainly the case that from the very beginning, there have been power struggles within the party, and that leaders have continuously purged even the individuals closest to them. There was an interesting comment that Mao Zedong made at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution when he talked about how one purge was leading to another, described it to the peeling of an onion. You start with the elements that are the most rotten, and then there is the next group that also needs to be dealt with, and so forth. And you know, it's an interesting point of view. Like, where does this come from? Why does he think that way? And so what preoccupied Mao Zedong? What kind of a person was he? Well, he was someone who was very deeply worried about his legacy. And the reason for that is he had concluded that the Soviet Union was no longer as communist as they should be. And so he was trying and struggling to figure out how exactly you prevent what happened in the Soviet Union from happening in China. So he was someone who was afraid that after he died, there would be a demollification and then the bureaucrats would take over and his whole life meaning would be rejected. And so when he was looking at potential successors, he was trying to figure out whether or not his deputies were people that deserved his trust. He expected that they would pretend to agree with him, but that maybe they actually weren't. So he was very paranoid. He was very sensitive to even the smallest differences. So all of these people kept trying to persuade him that they were loyal. And in many cases, they were so loyal to Mao that it was inconceivable that he could turn against them because these were his comrades from very early years. They were the ones who built the personality cult. So they were shocked that they would ever be able to do something that would lead to Mao losing their trust. But that's what happened, right? And so this also gets to one other idea, which is that when there are problems in a communist regime, often the reaction is to say that it's because they are doing so well that the bad guys are trying even harder to undermine them. And that also the more successful you are, the more people lose their guard and they're less vigilant. They become more vulnerable to corruption and losing that revolutionary elan, right? So this idea that the better you do doesn't necessarily mean you need to purge less. It might mean you need to purge more because the enemy is getting more ambitious and because the people around you are getting too self-confident.
That is certainly a way to make people feel insecure, threaten their lives. Okay. What major consequences, specifically that physical and psychological massacre of intellectuals of the Great Leap Forward, will we see as China continues to overpower the U.S. as a global superpower? By the way, I think China is currently overpowering the U.S. as a global superpower. That might change in 2 weeks, but if you're going to ask me who I think is winning, I think China's winning. So what are the consequences we're going to see from their Great Leap Forward?
Yeah, the Great Leap Forward, I think, is a moment in time that deserves a lot of attention. It's one of the greatest man-made disasters in history. It led to the death of 30 million people. And so when Xi Jinping came to power, one of his biggest preoccupations was how people talked about Chinese history. And he used this term historical nihilism. Well, what does that mean? Well, for him, it was a view of history that was not shaped by party values. Well, what are party values? Well, party values mean you don't talk about the party's mistakes in a way that suggests the party is not the inevitable organization to run the country. And so if people talk a lot about the 30 million people who died, for Xi Jinping, that's an existential problem. Because for Xi Jinping, if you don't believe in your own history, if you don't believe in your own civilization, if you don't believe in the party's mission, the game is up. And what's interesting is he's motivated in those views because of his view of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he gave this speech shortly after he came to power and said, why did the Soviet Union collapse? Well, one of the reasons was they lost control of their own history. So for Xi Jinping, talking about the past and what he sees as a needlessly negative way, for him is something that is a big problem.
A big part of the Great Leap Forward was the destruction of China's educated class. How do you think China sees their educated class right now? What is the general sentiment around Chinese citizens possessing more education, reading more, learning more, being able to access more? What's the feeling around that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as I was saying in a previous answer, Xi Jinping has gone for broke with this mission of mastering new technologies and making other countries dependent on China and putting all of these investments into making sure that China is a leading country for AI and batteries and electric cars. And to do that, you need to have smart people. You need to have educated people. You need to have people who understand these very technologically complicated devices. And so he wants people who studied overseas to return to China. He wants those people to be happy. Now, that, of course, bumps up into other agendas, right? So he doesn't want universities to be hotbeds of intellectual ferment that might lead people to speak out in ways that are dangerous to what he's trying to achieve. He also doesn't want oligarchs or very wealthy people to take steps that are not, in his view, conducive to the party's mission. And, you know, there have been perennial debates among academics, policymakers about how good authoritarian regimes can be at innovation, right? Whether or not a society that's not fully open can compete with one that is. And so Xi Jinping thinks that he can do that. And he talks a lot about the victories of the rocket and nuclear programs during the Cultural Revolution, right? And then says that, you know, this was an example of China, even though when the whole world was trying to isolate them, they were still able to make these giant technological achievements. So it will be interesting to see how those tensions play out.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely a catch-22. You can't have it both ways. You cannot have a culture that prioritizes innovation and educates their citizens with a domesticated, non-curious population. How great of an impact do you feel like the Great Leap Forward had on China's, I would say, relative, I wouldn't call it stagnation, but I feel like when you compare their AI innovations to the innovations of other countries, it's not a huge stretch to think that they should be a little bit further than they currently are, given their vast amount of wealth, great world power, and a large, very loyal population.
In 2015, China introduced this policy called Made in China. And the idea was that in 10 years, the country would make huge advancements in technological self-sufficiency. And what that meant was you were going to take all of this money that you had and you weren't going to use it to facilitate consumption, but you were going to invest it in strategic areas to ensure that China would be at the forefront of technological advancements. And they were successful in some ways, but not in others. They were successful in the fact that they have made these achievements that they've made, which are quite impressive, but it was a very costly thing because it's hard to find a way for the government to make sure that it's investing in the right places. And also there was all of this competition in different regions. So there was a lot of duplicative efforts that didn't need to happen. There was a lot of redundancies. There was a lot of money that was being spent that didn't go to good uses. There were a lot of companies that were founded to pursue this national agenda that then went bankrupt. So then it becomes a question of trade-offs, right? What would have happened if there hadn't been this very state-focused, oriented use of resources? There's a recent report that came out by the Rhodium Group that looks like this and said that it was kind of a mixed scoreboard for China's competitiveness and for growth, but that certainly in some ways by the state-directed project, they made a lot of sacrifices.
Before our interview, I listened to several military podcast episodes, and one talked about China as a recovering power, not a rising power. What does that mean exactly? And when you talk about the trade-offs China has to make, what trade-offs are they making? Like, what do they want to happen?
Perhaps this podcaster was thinking about China in a sort of long durée of what they looked like before the 19th century when the Chinese Empire included a third of the world's population and certainly had a lot of national power. In terms of where the Chinese military is right now, again, we're getting back to something that's come up earlier in the conversation. Xi Jinping has been purging a lot of leaders in the People's Liberation Army.
Purging? Is he killing them or is he just firing them?
I think most of them are going to jail. It's interesting, in the Chinese system, the people at the very top don't tend to face execution, which is a little bit different from the 1930s in the Soviet Union. It's the people who are lower on the totem pole that often face death. Some prominent figures certainly were executed for corruption, but that's not always the case. And in fact, the question of how far the purge goes, how the purge is characterized, how people are punished is an art form that is shaped by a multiplicity of considerations that are extremely difficult for people on the outside to put together and may only be fully understood by one specific individual, and that is Xi Jinping. But, you know, the fact that these purges are happening, nobody is quite sure why they're happening in the military. And a lot of people have been reflecting recently on the fact that the people who are being purged are former close associates of Xi Jinping and wondering how that's possible. If you're close to him, you need to be even more careful. It does raise questions about military capabilities. It's certainly the case that China has been putting a lot of resources into thinking about fighting a war with the United States over Taiwan. But if you don't fight wars, it's really hard to guess just exactly how competent your military is. And before you roll those iron dice, especially for a war that might put your entire regime into a dangerous spot, you want to be really sure, right? But the United States is looking at its military-industrial complex, trying to understand what the war might look like, trying to achieve technological breakthroughs that are able to undermine China's own advantages. And so that time horizon and who is benefiting is something really interesting.
So everyone who gets involved in Communist Party of China suffers in some way, even if they're at the top for one moment, pretty soon they might be facing prison or execution. Generally speaking, many governments, societies, religions, cults, etc., they're able to get people to leave their families and join replacement systems by promising them either happiness and comfort while living, or some form of glory in the afterlife. Communism is the only system I can think of that not only does not provide you with either of those things, but actively makes your life more miserable. How has it been able to recruit so many people to join it, to love it, to live by it and die by it, despite offering its constituents nothing but bread and lectures? That was maybe a lecture of my own.
So why people join the party in the first place and why they stay in the party can sometimes be different reasons too. So sometimes when young people in particular join the Chinese Communist Party or the Bolsheviks in Russia, they weren't entirely sure what they were going into. But if we look at why people join in the first place, I think one useful moment to look at these ideas is in the 1940s in China. So the communists had created a base area, the northwest of the country. The capital of this communist-controlled area was known as Yan'an. And for young people throughout China, this was an exciting thing. And the reason for that was the country had gone through decades of war. They lost against the Western powers, the collapse of the imperial system, civil war between the nationalists and the communists, and of course, the full-blown invasion of imperial Japan into China. And so young people were hoping to find a way out, to find salvation for their country. And so as many young people, when they arrived in Yan'an, they posed a problem because young people tend to be selfish. They tend to not want to listen to authority figures. They tend to have very strong opinions. But at the same time, those values coexisted with a recognition that only a united force in which people put the organization first would be the way to save China. So they went through this really emotionally grueling process known as rectification. And what that meant was using struggle sessions, self-criticisms, writing journals, reading other people's journals, deep self-reflection, introspection to find any example of individualism that contravened the party's interests and destroying it. And it was really hard for them. And people talk about how they couldn't sleep and the stress and the anxiety and the suffering, but that once they got through the gate and the party decided that they had transformed, that it was an ecstatic feeling, that it was this feeling of joy and that this idea that having become a cog in the machine, which is what something that they wanted to become once it was achieved, for them it was something deeply meaningful. And so they had this idea that by making something bigger than themselves and being a part of it and sacrificing for it, they saw a lot of meaning. And some people, when they were persecuted by their own party, lost hope and they committed suicide. Others did see their faith shaken. But many of them actually thought that when there was a divergence in what they thought and what the party told them, there was something wrong with them, not something wrong with the party. And that meant that they needed to look into themselves and not look into the party. And so when you think of everything that they sacrificed and how much the party sacrificed to emerge victoriously, for them, the memories of those martyrs were sacred and that they deserved respect and they felt inspired by them. And so I'm not saying that these are people who are morally justified in what they did for the party, but I think that it helps explain, you know, what their motivation was. And one other motivation I think was fear. Right? This idea that if you do buck the party, it's not actually going to make anything better. It's actually going to make things worse for the party to which you're loyal, but also be really bad for you in particular. You know, there was a lot of suffering. There was a lot of humiliation. The party turned against its own members on many occasions. But the fact that they didn't lose faith is something that I think speaks to the deep dedication and idealism that many of them felt. And it's a different life than I think many Americans are familiar with. It's interesting. I will say one last thing about this. Many times when I give this talk or something like this, someone who went to Catholic school will come up to me and say, A lot of what you said is not super unfamiliar to people who know certain parts of the Bible very well, and that many people have tried to find meaning in suffering and meaning in something bigger than themselves. And you know, there used to be something called the hair shirt that monks would put on that was really itchy and would deliberately cause physical torment because it was a way of focusing more on the spiritual and something bigger. What actually really reminds people of that often is this story that Xi Jinping used to tell about how when he was exiled to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution as a teenager, that he loved to read this novel called What is to Be Done by Chernyshevsky. It was a revolutionary novel that was also a big inspiration to Lenin and Trotsky. And there was this character in this novel called Rachmetov, and he used to sleep on a bed of nails because he thought that by toughening himself, he would be a better revolutionary warrior. And Xi Jinping said that to mimic this person, he used to walk around in the wind and the rain and the snow because he wanted to be like that person. This sort of self-abnegation for a bigger cause was something that he found to be something very meaningful.
Why do I feel like people are so much happier when they're able to be free and individualistic as opposed to when they are a collectivist? So what you just talked about, people are sacrificing their happiness and comfort for the good of the Chinese Party and the Communist Party. Something I found really interesting in your book, specific passage that jumped out at me, was that someone warned that individualism was like a germ that would infect a whole human body if even a tiny bit was allowed to enter, which I agree with. Once you allow people to form their own identities and dreams and ambitions and goals, I do not think they will ever naturally want to go back to a collectivist state. You're going to have to force them in some way too. And yet, I don't think the same is true for collectivism. If even one iota of it enters a human body, I think the body will aggressively work to kill it off. Why? There is this feeling just me being American-centric, and it's not shared by other people.
So there was this idea in the Chinese Communist Party during the Mao era, preventing your selfishness from making you do things that were not for the good of the party was a continuous struggle. It was a struggle that never ended. And in fact, it was the people who thought that the struggle was over because they were so great that were the most vulnerable to this germ of individualism, because pride is a form of individualism in a way, right? So it was this idea that because the germ will continue to grow if you let it, there was never equilibrium. There was never stasis. There had to be this continuing battle against selfishness. And that's why you had these continuous purges. That's why you had these self-criticisms. That's why you had all of these different campaigns. It was this idea that the molding, the shaping, the transformation never reaches an end state. Part of that, I think, is rooted in this idea that people are going to be people and that it's natural for people to not want to serve the organization all the time and give up everything constantly. The question for the regime, and something that really preoccupied Mao, is how you make that system permanent, how you can convince people to continuously war against selfishness and individualism. And so after Mao's death, I think a lot of people within the party said that we need to let off a little bit, and that part of the way that we can save the revolution counterintuitively is by moving away from some of those revolutionary legacies and letting people just live and say, if you don't bother the party, we'll let you make money, we'll let you have fun, we'll let you live this materialist lifestyle, we will let you travel, go overseas. And that made a lot of people happy. And now it seems to be the case that the current Chinese leadership has concluded that they went too far in the other direction. And so what they're trying to do is find a happy medium where you're not suffering from the extremism, the radicalism, the Cultural Revolution, but you're not in this spiritual crisis, vacuum of values that marked the post-Mao era when nobody believed in communism anymore. They weren't sure what to believe in. And for Xi Jinping, that's really a scary thing. So he's trying to rededicate people to the cause, and that's why he talks so much about the revolution, studying party history, and what happened at Yan'an. He says that's something that the party should continue to study now.
Just for our listeners, can you tell us what happened at Yan'an? Yan'an, okay. All right, I'm embarrassed myself enough already.
That's what I was talking about a few moments earlier. I guess I wasn't clear. This rectification of young people going to the communist base area. Yeah, he sees that as a model, right? So, you know, what that means is not clear, because struggle is an inherently ambiguous concept. It's not a legal term, right? So how you're able to use economic development and making people live more comfortable lives, but also giving up too much on the struggle mindset, the vigilance, is something that they're trying to figure out. And it's not an easy thing to balance.
No, and I cannot imagine the next 20 years are going to be peaceful for China. So we are coming up on time, but I do have one final question for you, which is, at our core, do you think we are more individualistic or collectivist? Do you think it is more innately human to want to serve yourself or want to be a part of a tribe?
I think that this is a deeply personal question and one that people will have different answers to. And people might feel differently about it at different times of their lives. Maybe people are just born different. Maybe people who come up in different societies are socialized to think about the world in a particular way. And perhaps it may not even be a good idea to totally essentialize it in the sense that you can live a life of service, a life of meaning, a life of selflessness that isn't a communist life, that isn't living a life according to the Chinese Communist Party. What people choose ultimately, I think, should be their own choice. And what happened in the Maoist era and in the Soviet Union, it suddenly became a world where you didn't have a choice, where there was only one answer to the question that you just asked me. And that was because these were regimes that were totalizing. They were built on the idea that you could fundamentally restructure human society in a different way, that you were the last phase of history, that you were going to bring the world to a place where you wouldn't have to worry about want and need. And what's interesting is even according to Marx and Engels, the idea was that the state would wither away. So for communists, in theory, you would reach a point where you wouldn't have a state anymore and everybody would be able to be happy and make their own choices. And that would be because of the level of economic development that people had reached. And so what did emerge in China, the Soviet Union, was not a state that was withering, but a state that was all-powerful. And there was this idea that the state needed to use violence and mobilization to change people's behaviors. And now we're at a point where in China, the leaders are trying to figure out how to win over a third generation in this revolutionary project. And how much of that will be ideational, winning people over to the idea and to the mission, and how much of that will be by facilitating a better life for people and a nicer home and a wealthier family and more opportunities? We'll see, because what they're trying to do now is sort of have their cake and eat it too, a world in which people are dedicated, but also not living in penury and not feeling like they need to, you know, give their whole lives to the state. But for Xi Jinping, the party, right, people who are members of the party, that's different from regular citizens of China, right? So Xi Jinping has said that if you want to join the party, don't do it because you want to live an easy life, because it's a different kind of organization. It's one where it's about your service. And the people who join the party, I think many times in the past, they did it because they wanted to have a career. And Xi Jinping is saying, it's not going to be like that anymore. It's going to be more old school. It's going to be a different kind of life.
So do you think they're going to be successful in converting this third generation?
I think it's the thing that Xi Jinping thinks a lot about. I think he thinks a lot about his own mortality and how he is going to hand off to a leader who pursues the agenda as he's defined it for the country. And I think he thinks a lot about how the younger people who did not witness the revolution and were not raised by the revolutionary generation will commit their lives to the national mission and struggle. And so that's one of the reasons why the relationship between China and the United States has grown so tense, is because Xi Jinping believes that America is betting on that generation to have a different set of values. And that's, like I said, what he sees as the war without gunpowder. And so for them, it's existential. These generational issues are something that they really think a lot about.
Well, I am definitely going to be thinking about it a lot too. Thank you so much for coming on my show, Joseph.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Delete TikTok.